When don't let people mistake your kindness for weakness. Most people don't, and they would never think about it, and they appreciate the kindness that you're receiving. However, we are living in a society where some people think that because you're being nice to them, that you must be weak. And I have a rule that if you mistake my kindness for weakness, I cut you off. And it comes back to that warrior part of me, and again, you think I'm being weak because I'm being kind to you? Like, I'm being kind to you. I'm giving you the opportunity to, you know, I want you to win in life, and you're treating me like I'm a mug. I'm like, there's 7 billion other people on earth I can be kind to, but I won't be kind to you anymore.
You are now entering the information stream, a physical and digital world. No matter where you live or where you are, a device and connection brought you here, where you and I now interact. Together, we will challenge our basic assumptions and approach to life in the 21st century. Together, we will change the world. Welcome to 21st Century Freak, and I'm your host, Edward Veeam. Welcome to 21st Century Freak. I'm your host, Edward Veeam, and today I'm joined by Patrick Hamilton Walsh. Patrick is a fantastic man. He grew up in poor Ireland during the revolution, where he saw more car bombs than he did Porsches, as his way of putting it, but decided when he was 16 that he wanted more. So he wrote down 3 goals: Old Trafford tickets, a Porsche, and to travel the world. And by 27, he was driving in his Porsche. He had his Old Trafford tickets, and 3 years later, he set off to travel the world and has since traveled to over 140 countries, and he is now based in Stockholm. In Stockholm, he is the co-founder of the Future Talent Council, and previously, he was the chief commercial officer at SALT, a school of applied technology, believing that everyone should be able to live, learn, work, and participate in the digital world. Most recently, he received an honorary insignia from the King of Sweden for his work on the Nepalese earthquake in 2015. This was a fantastic conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I do. And remember, be kind. Here comes Patrick. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Edward.
It's great to have you.
The honor is all mine.
And typically, how I begin is a short meditation. So if you don't mind, we can close our eyes, take a few deep breaths. And if we open our eyes slowly, the world streams in. And it's in this stream of consciousness, or the information stream, where the listeners are, where we're all pretty much the same. Yeah, you're Patrick, and I'm Edward, and whoever's listening, you're you. But more than that, we're all experiencing this all at the same time with no effort. And that makes me believe we're more similar than different. And it makes me believe that together we can change the world. It's a beautiful world, a thriving world. And with that said, I typically begin with 2 questions. Who are you and why are you here?
I am Patrick Hamilton Walsh. I am here because I traveled the world for 7 years with a backpack. I went to 140 countries across all 7 continents. And every day I hung out with amazing, beautiful, kind souls. And one of the journeys that I did is that I drove from London to Sydney overland. And 2 days after arriving in Australia, I went into a backpackers bar in Sydney and I met a girl from Västerås. And that it was the start of the journey as to how I ended up sitting in this beautiful neighborhood in Stockholm, surrounded by trees, fallen, you know, with the leaves falling off, a blue sky, and sitting across from a beautiful soul like you, Edward. That's who I am. Why I'm here, deepest level is because I feel like Stockholm is at the forefront of the world in many ways. At the spiritual battle level, at the technological advancement level, at the most levels of extreme kindness, and at probably at the most levels of extreme unkindness. And those are the sort of battles that I want to be confronted with.
Beautiful. Thank you. 140 countries. Kind of what I hear in your voice, I also hear it in the story there, like that exploring part seems to be a huge part of you. And you strike me as quite fearless, and not in the sense that you're indestructible, but in the sense that you're willing to be very vulnerable. And I think it can be heard in your voice. I also think it can be understood if you're traveling 140 countries, you need help from a lot of people typically along the way. And maybe you learned it along the way, or maybe it's something you've always carried with you. But I hear that openness in your voice. And it's really beautiful to hear when you speak, how you don't speak from a sense of absolute truth or know-how, but your truth and what you think is right. And that, you know, that's what you're going to provide. And that's why you're here in Sweden. You found the place you think conflicts those important battles on the planet, in our lives. And then you've chosen to stay here because you feel like this is where you can really, really continue to explore those, let's call them conflicts, but I think perhaps challenges, and do good with them. That's what I sense. You want to do good. It's beautiful.
Kindness is the goal. You know, to be kind covers a lot.
Mm.
You know, that's more, it's tangible as well.
Mm.
Kindness. So, can I ask you, who are you and why are you here?
Yeah. So I'm Edward, I'm a 21st century freak. And I felt a lot of panic, anxiety, and confusion around the world for a long time. And I tried to find the absolute truth for the world. And I wanted to give that truth to other people because I wanted to improve the world. And I wanted to understand the world because I felt like this sense of anxiety and panic came from me not being able to understand why there is conflict, why there is war, why there is so much malice and terror in the world. Even though there's so much beauty, but especially the media stream convinced me that there was so much ugliness out there. And I tried to find the truth, and of course I didn't, you know, there's a lot of brilliant people out there, and I'm definitely by far not the most brilliant. And so I had this experience of community and deep human connection. And I'd experienced them before, but perhaps at a younger age, so I wasn't really able to integrate the experience. But afterwards, I felt like I finally had understood the world, like I finally had understood myself, like I finally had understood the way to a good life. And I realized that it was in relationship with others and relationship with myself. But it wasn't based on this absolute truth. Instead, it was based so much more on understanding and empathy and openness and being able to put myself in other people's shoes. And through that exchange, realizing that, wow, whatever this person is sharing with me right now, like I'm mirroring so much of it. I feel so much of that myself. It's almost like I'm speaking to myself as I'm listening to this person. And seeing more and more how, damn, we're not that different. We're all the same. And so this quest to understand the world became a quest to connect the world. And that's who I am. I'm here to connect the world. And I'm happy to live in the 21st century, to be a 21st century freak where we can go local to global with a device and connection. And instantly, we have the potential to literally connect the whole world to the same message. And it doesn't have to be the same truth, but I think the same message. And like you, kindness for me should be the message every time. And I'm here today because I felt that sense of kindness from you. And unfortunately, I think it's kind of rare today to meet really, really kind people. And I was very curious then, where does this kindness come from? And I've also noticed this ability to articulate why it's important in you, and an ability to communicate why it's worth it, and why there is no other way. And so I'm here today to explore that. Why do we need kindness, and why is it so important?
For me, kindness encompasses everything which is good about our world and about our interactions within the world. And it's the simplest, most easiest way for us to have a positive impact on the world whilst elevating ourselves at the same time. Because you can't really fake kindness, because even if you're faking it, it's happening for real, you know? And I say this a lot, and people freak out when I say it, but I'm not a nice person, and I'm not a humble person, and I don't have any intention of being nice or humble, and I have a good reason for it. I think there's too many fake nice people around, you know, I'm so nice, but there's no substance behind it. And it's like that Hollywood vibe where, you know, yeah, you're awesome and you're great and all that, but it's soulless, it's emptyless. There's no weight behind it. So being nice is not my goal. So I have no goal to be nice. At the same time, being humble is not my goal, because there's so many fake people around with fake humility. Again, it's nonsense. And when you see them drop their mask, you realize they're not humble at all. So I don't have a goal to be humble either. And I'm not humble. Like, I have big goals that I want to achieve in this world, and they're not humble by any stretch of the imagination. And they haven't been since I was 16 and designed my dream life, living in the unemployment black spot of Europe in Northern Ireland. However, kindness has got real weight. It's got substance. And by being kind to people and constantly looking for ways to be kind, I'm always making an impact on my society and on the people around me, because I don't have I'm not tuned in to what the media says. So I don't really know what's going on in the world, but I'm always super aware of what's going on in my world. And that's what I can see with my eyes. So if I'm standing in the queue at Max or Starbucks or anywhere like that, I will be kind to the people before and behind me, and I'll have a chat with them and find a way to compliment them, a genuine compliment. I'll also be kind to the person who serves me. And it's actually happened to me in Stockholm. I was in a part in southern Stockholm. I don't even know where it was, actually, and I didn't remember ever being there before. This was a few years ago. And I said to the guy who was serving me water in Ica Nara, I said, "Bro, I like your hair." Because you could see this guy put effort into his hair and it looked good and it was sort of his thing. And he goes, his answer was, "I know, you told me last time." I didn't remember the guy. I never remember being even that part of town, you know, whatever. Or maybe he moved from one shop to another.
Yeah.
But he was like, "I know, you told me." And I was like, "That's it, bro. Awesome." You know, and my response is, I will find a way to compliment somebody where it's intentional and it's true and I mean it, because people feel your intention. So don't bullshit people. I mean, if you can't find a way to compliment them, don't say nothing, because by bullshitting compliment, it actually diminishes both of you.
Yeah. But
in fact, you can probably tell everyone that they've done a good job, because people rarely screw up, actually. You know, if you go and order a burger and they give you the wrong burger, it's probably 1 in 1,000.
Yeah.
What they got wrong. And it's probably not even their fault. It's someone behind.
Yeah.
So why go nuts? Just say, "Bro, no problem. I'm happy that you screwed up with me, because you'll be able to flip it around in like 2 minutes and give me the actual burger and I'm not that stressed."
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But for me, just looking for the kindness in the moment to moment situations, like being the guy who smiles first when someone catches your eye, you know? I think it carries enough weight and enough substance to cover nearly every situation, especially when people are having a bad day or being pissed off at you. And the thing is, I don't know why they're having a bad day. And I don't even know if they're having a bad year. And that means I don't know if their kid is sick, if they're going through a divorce, if they're not liking their boss. I don't know. But let me just try and find the kindness in it.
Hmm.
I love that. And I also like the distinction between being nice and kind.
Yeah.
Because I think that's so important. I think especially today we live in a society where I think a lot of exterior things count. So putting on a nice mask counts, but being kind actually doesn't. And we worship people that are nice, but we don't really worship people that are kind. And we tend to live in a society where that ability to put on a mask is actually benefits a lot of people. Not in the long run. I mean, I think that in the long run, you'll lose people, you'll lose reputation, etc. But in the short run, you can find a way to climb. And when you live in such an accelerated society where change is so imminent, every single moment we see a new development. It's a completely new world where we're swapping spots and places all the time. And so I think that people that wear masks easily hide today. And so it's so important to make that distinction between nice and kind. And also the fact that you're not just being kind for like your own self. I think that's the big difference too. Like being nice, the way you define it, it sounds like you're kind of looking to win in a situation. Like I present myself as nice. Whereas being kind is about us winning.
Yeah.
And that's such a different approach. It goes from the I to the we. And once there's a we, at least in my experience, that's where the fulfillment comes in as well. But you mentioned you designed a life plan when you were 16 and you were born in the unemployment box of North Ireland, you said?
Yeah,
so get into that a little bit.
I grew up in an area called a village called Claddy, which was it's in Northern Ireland, so it's in the UK. But it's right on the border beside the Republic of Ireland, which meant there was a British army camp at the bottom of our street at my house. Mm-hmm. So we had a lot of bombings and shootings against British soldiers. And I mean, we seen dead people outside our street with their heads literally like one dot at the front of their third eye, you could say, as you could imagine in India, but the mm-hmm. rest of their head gone at the back.
Yeah.
And I don't have a poor me story about my upbringing at all, because my upbringing is the only one that I'm aware of that existed. I didn't know there was places like Stockholm where Porsches drove past your front door. We were all rich in the regard that we were all poor, but we were all equally poor. Mm-hmm. And we had no comparison. I sometimes think it may be more difficult to grow up poor in Stockholm than it is in Northern Ireland, because you have more reference points as to what you don't have.
Mm.
Whereas we don't have that. We just thought, we have enough to get by.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
In Ireland, it does take a village to raise a kid. So we all would eat in, you know, different parents' house and be shared around different, you know, families and stuff like that, because that's how it's done in Ireland.
Mm.
Necessarily as well. I can go into that later. But when I was 16, we were at this night out. It's the best night in our town, called the Flower of Sweet Strabane. And I was there. And everyone was dressed up and having a great time. And I was looking around going, wow, this is not for me. I want more. I want more.
Mm.
And more is quite an abstract thing. What is more? What do you want?
Yeah.
And I realized that I had to define what I wanted. So I actually wrote a book about this called Life Is. And in the book, I talk about how I asked myself two very simple questions. The first question was, what do I want? Because more means nothing. Everyone wants more. What do you want? What three things do you want specifically? If you could have any three things, no matter how crazy it is, what would they be? And so at that stage of my life, I knew exactly what I wanted. And the first thing I wanted more than anything in the world as a 16-year-old boy was to have season tickets at Old Trafford. That was the dream.
Okay, yeah, United fan, yeah. I love it.
Second was to have a Porsche before I was 30. Mm. And third was to travel the world.
Mm.
Now, people thought I was completely nuts. I had never seen a Porsche in my life. Ever. I knew they existed from TV, but I had seen more car bombs than sports cars. You know, cars were on fire where we lived and stuff. And then travel the world, that idea sort of came from watching James Bond and stuff on a Saturday night on the BBC, seeing him sailing off, you know, on his boat, you know, into these magical destinations. And I had a desire that I wanted that. But I had a big problem, Edward, and my problem was that I wasn't good at anything. I didn't shine in any way. No one ever picked me out and says, you will do this or you'll be good at that. No one. In fact, the opposite. So whenever I thought about it, I asked, like, what am I good at? Like, am I good at anything? No. Am I okay at anything? I'm okay at maths at school. I don't like it. I'm not interested. It's not a thing for me, but maths, yeah, I can do it. I can do my homework easy. So I thought, what's the best I can do with that thing? And I thought, I can be an accountant, because they deal with numbers and they deal with money. So if they deal with money, they must be rich. So therefore, that'll help me get season tickets at Old Trafford, a Porsche, and help travel the world. That was my logic. Of course, where I lived, I didn't know any Porsche. I didn't know any accountants or anything like that. So Monday morning, I'm in school, and I decided to change my life. And I didn't do anything big. What I simply did is I started listening to the teacher. I just listened. If she told me to write something down, I wrote it down. If she told me to do my homework, I did my homework. But I was, and I, the other thing is, I slowly moved over the next few months from the back of the class with the lads, towards
the front,
near the front, not quite the front. Okay, you know what I mean?
Not first.
Because I was still
tickets.
One of the lads.
Yeah.
You know? So near the front, and go forward 6 years, go forward 10 years. I write down my dream life. I write it down and I keep it where I can see it. That's the most important thing that anyone can do when it comes to achieving goals and achieving their dream life.
Think about
what you
down.
Want, write it down, and be able to look at it every day.
Every day.
I have my new dreams in front of my phone, so I see it every time I open my phone. I'm 26 years old. I have come top of the class in school. I have become the first person from my area to go to university. No one has ever been. And I've just qualified as a chartered accountant with Grant Thornton, that I've moved to PricewaterhouseCoopers to become a taxation lawyer, doing the tax exams. And every Friday night I leave the office in my suit and I take the bus to the airport and I fly to Manchester. I've got two season tickets. I go over there, get party, get drunk, be a dickhead, watch the football. I'm 27. I come out of the office on a Friday night, jump into my Porsche, drive to the airport, go to Manchester, get drunk, watch the match, do what lads do.
Yeah.
And when I'm 28 in May 2007, I'm now, I've done QFA, Qualified Financial Advisor, I'm a tax lawyer, I'm a chartered accountant, I'm a member of three professions, I've got two degrees, and I have this nice career going, and I tell people that's it. I have one more thing I want to achieve in life, and I want to see the world. So I didn't go for 7 years, I just went. And people thought I was crazy. And would you hear why they thought I was crazy? Because I had a defined benefit pension. One of these magical pensions from the old world that you'd never get it anymore. Okay, and like, your life is set, Patrick. All you have to do is stick this out for 40 years and you'll get your defined benefit pension.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, like, you think that I'm going to define my life by this defined pension?
Yeah.
You know, they thought I was crazy. They still think I'm crazy.
Yeah.
Because I left that pension behind and they were right. I didn't never get that pension again. But I had 7 years backpacking the world.
Yeah.
And now I'm sitting across from you in beautiful Stockholm in the autumn.
And where did you go first? What was the first country?
Well, what Instagram has become, I was basically the first person to do that. I knew my camera, my digital camera in those days had 2 megapixels. And Nokia was relaunched. They were launching an N95 with a 5 megapixel camera, which was mind blown back then. And it was available in Helsinki or in Fifth Avenue flagship store in New York.
Okay.
And I've never had any love to travel to America or anything, but I thought, oh, I might as well start off there.
Yeah.
So I flew to New York, hung out for a couple of weeks, and then I drove from coast to coast. You know, I drove over to LA.
Yeah.
And I set up a group called Nothing But a Nokia on Facebook, which I found out about a week later in a swimming pool with a girl who told me there was a new thing called Facebook where everyone was staying in touch in 2007. And I was like, can I sign up? She goes, do you have a blah blah account? I was like, I don't think so. Let me try. And it worked off my Gmail.
Okay.
So I signed up for Facebook. I have Gmail, but I think up until a couple of months or something before that, you needed like an Ivy League
email
exactly. address or something.
Yeah.
So I started just taking photographs and posting in real time as I traveled around the world. And I traveled the world just with a mobile. So that, it sounds normal now, but that was my alarm clock and my calculator and my phone and my internet. You know, it was everything. Whereas before you'd like need like 10 different items.
Exactly.
You could travel the world.
I just needed that one.
And to do it with just a phone was crazy. And I actually started taking a selfie at 3 o'clock, what later became known as a selfie, at 3 o'clock every day. So my alarm would go off and I would take a photo and the thing that would change would be the background. So wherever I went in the world, it would be my face. And there was actually an article done in New York a few years later about Kim Kardashian's competition for the inventor of the selfie. It was in a book called Life and Style or something in New York. And it was me. They said that I was the guy who invented the selfie as well.
That's awesome.
I should have screenshotted the article at the time, man, because I can't find it now.
The
magazine, it all still exists.
Yeah.
So that type of nonsense I was into early days. And my goal was to travel the world coast to coast, always overland and always with people. Because for me, it was about education. I've now graduated 7 times. I'm a member of 4 professions. But my true education comes from the definition of what the word is. And that's a Latin word, just means to flower the mind, to open and flower the mind.
Yeah.
And my true education was 7 years of just being in places like Pakistan, Namibia, Botswana, Kazakhstan, and hanging out with the people, being kind to them and receiving their kindness in return. Because the thing about backpacking is, it doesn't matter how wealthy you are. If you're an asshole, you're screwed.
Yeah.
But if you're kind, it doesn't matter how poor you are. They will take you in. They will take care of you. They will look after you. They will, you know, pitch you up in their homes.
Yeah.
The world is full of beautiful people with kind, open hearts who want to give and are searching for ways to give. And it's something that when I look back, I actually grew up in that society as well, because poor people are generally like that. And I used to have a thing where it doesn't really work in Sweden, but I would, once a month at least, I would always look out for a way to pay for the person in front of me's groceries. So I would see them stacking up their stuff in like ICA. And I would say, oh, it doesn't matter, I'll get yours. And it might cost me 50 euros. And in Ireland, it was a lot easier. And in other places, Australia, I would leave it like, why? And I was like, man, I just pay it forward, you know. And they would get it. But in Sweden, people would freak out about me trying to pay for it. And I'm like, just you bag it up and walk away. And I'll put my stuff forward. And they're like, what's this guy up? They're a bit more suspicious. But it works quite well with immigrants, actually.
Okay.
So I do get to do it from time to time in Sweden, but more what I can do is be kind human to human.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing that people really respond to most in this society, is kindness and compliments.
Well, let's get into kindness a bit more, because I think it's so important, obviously, in this conversation. So partly it's giving compliments. How else do you define being kind?
I think it's the intention behind what you're doing for people. People can always feel intention. So let's say I'm in a shop and there's a girl in front of me. That girl will feel if I'm being kind to be kind, or if I'm being kind to be a sleazebag, because I think there's something else in it, or I'm playing a longer game. And so I always have to check in on my intention. Am I being, like, why am I being kind to Edward? Do I want something for him, or am I being kind to give? So I must always check my intention as well. And more at the start. You know, whenever you come into a society, you're like, why am I doing this? And the more you do it for the right reasons and your intentions are pure, then the more that's it. But still, time to time, you have to check in and go, you know, what's in it for me? And a lot of the time, what's in it for me is the response that I get to giving something with positive intentions for the for the benefit. I always have a thing that I want people to win in life.
Yeah.
Like, I want you to win in life, man. Like, the more Edwards that we have shining at their brightest level, the better the world is. Because no matter who you are, no matter how much of a dickhead you have been in the past, you're probably doing it because you really want to win for yourself. And you think that when you get there, then everything will be good for you.
Yeah.
And the truth is, it won't be if you're a dick. But I hope that on the path somewhere along the way, you can realize that the best way to get there is to go, you said this earlier, is to go there as a we. What's in it for all of us? How do we all win? How do we all grow? How does it benefit more people?
And did this start at 16?
When
Was it along your travels?
No, this actually was in me. This is one of the things that I've had. I was blessed. I'm blessed to be surrounded by women all my life. Good women. Like, I grew up with many aunts and many uncles as well, but I've always been surrounded by great women in my village, the neighbors and my mother's friends and my sister and her friends and cousins and all. And I've always had what I'm talking about is something that's always been in me, but I probably lost it a little bit in my teenage years. You know, my teenage years weren't too bad, but that was probably the time when I lost it a wee bit. And I probably lost it a wee bit whenever I was in my accounting years, because I've just told you something there and people listen to it and they don't really drop it in. I'm a member of 4 professions and I've done 7 qualifications in total. That's a lot of hard work, man. And to push yourself to that extreme level to be able to achieve that, you must be doing something wrong, really, in life. You know, you must have lost the reason for being. If you're so driven to do 2 professions at the same time, like studying for two, like going to 2 sets of classes at the same time simultaneously to provide for 2 exams down the line.
Yeah.
And I'm not a smart guy. You know,
I'm just grinding 18 hours a day.
Grinding and working for PwC at the same time. So how's Thursdays look? You know, so I'm studying, I'm grinding, I'm pushing. And that's not healthy, obviously. No. I mean, nobody does that in that short time frame. And my goal is that I knew that if I had to do it normal way, I would be like 32, 33 if I didn't fail any.
And would you say that you were in a sense a bit robotic during those years? Were you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like completely robotic. I mean, almost that those years are almost a
blur.
A blur to me because I was just in, I don't know people crash and burn. I don't know how close I was, but I pushed and I grinded and I went through. I'm an expert at passing exams. I know everything about passing exams. That doesn't mean I know everything about the subjects that I was trying to study for, because there's a technique to getting through things as well, and so I was good at getting that technique, being able to extract information, look at patterns and exams, you know, and extract things that way and get myself to a stage where I could get a pass and move on. And and just so people can understand this too, I've only started to realize this the past few years, but I was thinking, what drove me? And I've realized that it's probably the same thing that drives a lot of people who do something extreme in some way. And it's actually shame. Shame is a horrible frequency to be on.
Yeah.
And it's sort of difficult to have shame in Sweden. It's more difficult to have shame in a rich society than in a poor society. Because my shame sort of came from the poverty we were in eventually. The way I said it earlier, that, you know, it was easier to be poor in Ireland when everyone was poor, but I think you still feel it. And I think my shame came from the poverty that we had, and I had two options, and one of the options was to feel despair, which would drain me, or the other one was to feel angry at my situation, which if you channel anger in the right way, it can fuel you.
Yeah.
And in our society now, particularly in this society where we live now, anger is frowned upon at such a high level. You know, for someone to be angry or pissed off is like the worst thing you could probably be. And I'm trying to say this to people all the time, like, all your emotions are valid. They all have their place in your world, and it depends on how you work with them.
Yeah.
Back then when I was a young lad in my teens and in my 20s, I took the shame, and the output that came from that was anger. And it came from that was fuel to drive and push myself to do all those exams and studies and qualifications. And for all the effort I put in, I was able to go pull out the valve and let myself decompress of 7 years. So I don't have a work-life balance now, and I probably won't have. But for everything I put into those 7 years of being completely focused on achieving these goals that I had set myself for as a wee boy, I was able to also have a result where I says, what do I need to do and what do I want? And that's where it balanced, because what I needed to do, give me what I wanted at the end. And that was, I had a Porsche, I had season tickets, I traveled to 140 countries, you know.
But when you went into your travels, like being that kind of robotic delivery machine who's always executing on goals and always getting the task done, did you carry that with you initially during your travels? Did you have a sense of restlessness? Like, did it take a long time for you to settle into the travel, or did it feel like you were executing on a goal because you'd written it down
when
you were 16?
It felt the second, actually. The thing that I always love, I love people.
Mm.
And me being around people and me being inquisitive and being curious. So landing in New York, like I remember I flew, how I got to New York is, step by step, I went on the tram, met cool people on the tram. Then I got the bus to the airport where I was sitting beside more cool people. And then I flew to Madrid where I was sitting beside two Irish girls who were going on a summer thing, whatever. And then from Madrid, I flew to New York where I sat beside a guy called Jesus Reña, who's one of the most famous violin players in the world.
Oh, hell yeah.
And then I remember the next guy was in a taxi. I was talking to the driver.
Mm.
And then I landed at my mate's house. And after that, I met a bunch of girls in a bar. And that was my first 24 hours. And I can remember all those people vividly, because it was, my journey had started the moment I closed the door of my apartment and sort of put my keys through the box. Yeah. That was me, man.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm always present with people. I don't know why other people aren't, because it's just my natural thing. When I'm with people, I'm present. I'm there. Yeah. I'm focused. I'm in the game with them.
Mm.
And when I'm with people, I'm not thinking about the exams and all that. And I think the other thing is, there's a difference between passing your exams and graduating. You pass your exams months before and you get your qualification then, you know, later on. So the excitement is in the opening the envelope.
Mm.
And then everything else is just,
yeah,
you know, unwinding and letting everything go. Like, I've done it.
Yeah.
And there was a real sense of achievement for me coming from where I was. Like, I went way past my, I just wanted to be an accountant. I just wanted to get one degree. Like, to get a degree was such a big deal for me.
Yeah.
And then I went off and got seven. I've been up in front with my little board and my cloak seven times.
But I'm curious then, because that's also, you know, it's that when you're traveling, you're faced with novelty all the time, versus when you're working, you get into that kind of grind, that robotic mm-hmm. sense that we were speaking of earlier. When you were faced with all that novelty, like, what other insights hit you beyond kindness of what it means to, because like, now you reflect back and you realize you weren't really being alive. Like, yeah, you were an employee and an excellent one, but you weren't really alive. You weren't really focusing on what Patrick is and needs and wants. What other things did you discover about yourself on your travels?
Yeah, thanks for that. Because in my book, Life Is, that's the conclusion, is that I wasn't a human being, I was a human doing. And that book is about so what I've just told you is the intro, and then the rest of the book is the amazing things that I have been able to achieve, like Guinness World Records and dinners with presidents and everything else. The being part, because we are human beings, was something I just slipped into. It it's my natural state, actually. It was the doing was my unnatural state, so it was easier to remember who I was and forget about who I wasn't and let go of it, almost like a weight that I had been carrying in my hand, and I was able to just let open my hand and let it drop. What I realized as I traveled the world is that we are all the same. You've touched on it earlier. We are all the same. And I think if I was to be very blunt about it, what people want from life is, number one, they want to get themselves to a position where their kids are better off than they are. They want to elevate their life for their kids. And people want to feel part of something.
Yeah.
And that's good and bad, depending on what you've allowed to enter your mind.
Yeah.
You know? I have a thing where I will always, as long as you believe it, I will sit and accept your thing that you're telling me. As long as you believe it genuinely, please tell me it and let me listen. And if you think that Paul Potts was right and that everyone who reads and writes should be murdered off and we take the world back to year zero, if you think that's right, like, tell me why, because I'm interested to hear in that, man. I won't judge you, but I can read and write, and therefore it means that you want me gone as well.
Yeah.
So, but no matter what, as long as you're open, as long as you're telling your truth as you see it, and the more probably different that is from mine, the more I want to hear about it. Because I think you meet these great people when you're traveling the world, people who will tell you what they think about the world and how they see it, and they'll tell you the truth. And that's all I want, because that's where I learn. But I think when you're in cities and people are bumping into each other all the time, they will tell, as you say, they'll put on a mask and tell you what you want to hear.
Yeah.
Two things comes out of that. I think Sweden is, I won't say Sweden, I think Stockholm is the place where I've been where it's the least freedom of speech.
Yeah, it's an extremely narrow corridor of opinion.
The
yeah.
bandwidth is so small, and the yeah. topics that you can talk about openly are is so narrow.
Yeah.
Unless you go to a dinner party and people really start to trust you in a little way.
Yeah, and get their booze on.
Yeah, yeah. You know. Then you probably won't hear what people think. And I think that's one of the things that I love about traveling. And just to give you another insight, my life, I live two lifestyles. I have a 1-star life and a 5-star life. So 5-star, you know what 5-star is. You go to the best hotels, you get the nicest sheets, you have the best view in the nicest room with the best chef. And I love that. And my wife loves that. Particularly. But where the magic happens for me on a yearly basis is in the 1-star lifestyle. Because in the 1-star lifestyle, I put a backpack on me, I fly to a place and I book into a hostel or something, and I could be sharing a dorm with 40 people. And there I get to meet life. Yeah. And I get to meet honesty. I get to meet hear stories. And I get to laugh a lot, man.
Yeah.
Because the thing about hostels that people don't realize when it comes to backpackers hostels, a lot of them were ex-hotels and stuff like that. A lot of them are really cool places to stay. It's just that you're sharing more rooms with tighter with the people. And the other thing is that it's about people coming together who like people. And the average age of a backpacker in a hostel is 42 years old.
Oh, wow.
And the other thing about it is that I've met some of the richest people I've ever met. The most successful people I've ever met are in hostels. Because these people are successful because they like people. You know, the greatest path to success is liking people, through helping people, through giving, through caring, through sharing.
Yeah.
And that's the sort of people actually that you meet in hostels. They want to always go back to the basics and what matters, instead of being surrounded by sycophants who kiss their ass and tell them how great they are. And they might get that in their work, they might get that in their normal life, but you won't get that in the hostel.
Yeah.
Because in a hostel, it's not about where you're coming from. It's about where you're at. Where are you as a human being? Are you a good human?
No. Yeah. No, and for me, I mean, it's exactly like you're saying. Like I was on in the beginning, there, I wanted the truth to understand the world. And then I realized the only way to understand the world is through people. Because it's in that relationship, like you say, realizing that we're the same. But also, that's when you get to hear that, like, those little nuggets. Like there's so many people out there that carry these golden nuggets, and the only way they're going to give you those nuggets is by you showing that intention of kindness, listening, and being open. And then you get those little nuggets from people. And you mentioned there a Guinness World Record and also dinners with presidents. I'm assuming those were a few nuggets that came along the way.
Yeah,
could you get into that a little bit?
Guinness World Record again. So me and my wife, we picked two. My girlfriend at the time, we picked two points on the map, and the two points were, let's take a train. Let's do a big train journey. Where should we go? Let's go from the Arctic to the equator by train. How should we do that? Well, let's go to the very top of Norway, to the Arctic Ocean, a place called Narvik, and let's take a train all the way to Singapore. Can we do it? Can do anything. Yeah. Let's work it out. So we took a train all through the Nordics, down into St. Petersburg, through Moscow, down through Mongolia, China, Southeast Asia, and into Singapore. And great, brilliant trip. And then my wife was going back to her studies in Dublin. And it was actually, I think it was the 22nd of October, jumps out at me for some reason, that we heard that they were going to do a Guinness World Record for Leukemia Trust to help kids with leukemia. And all you had to do was to break the Guinness World Record, we need to sit on a fairground attraction for 24 hours and 50 minutes. Don't forget, we had just done a train from the Arctic to the equator.
Yeah. Your ass must be sore at this point.
Ours was tough, man. You know what I mean? We can handle it. You put us in any small confined room or space for any amount of time, it's going to be a gift for us.
Yeah.
So we did that, and we broke the Guinness World Record, and we made a lot of money for charity. And it was because we had, like, one of the trips we did as part of the Trans-Siberian through the Russia, it was 3.5 days from Moscow to Yekaterinburg, I think it was. And we were just... I went in on this trip, and there was a load of young Russian soldiers, and I didn't know, because we were going third class, which is plastic hearty, because first class is just me and my wife in a cubicle. What's the point in that? Second class is me and my wife with two Germans. What's the point in that? And it's always almost two Germans.
Yeah.
But third class was no doors, everything opened, like nine beds to a carriage, would be supposed to be a carriage, but they're all seats that fold up or down. And so we get on this train, and there's loads of young Russians going back to the countryside in Siberia where they're from after training, whatever. So I walk up the train and I see these lads, and I'm like, all right, lads, just give them a thumbs up, you know, no stress. And I come back and they're like, come. And I'm like, I don't drink vodka. I don't drink spirits. Like when I was drinking, I'd drink beer or champagne. But they were like, come. And they were like, they wanted to give me some vodka. And of course, we're going to be 3.5 days on a train with these young lads. So I thought, I don't want to be rude and disrespect them, so I'll take some vodka. 3.5 days later, man, I'm still sitting there with the lads singing like Russian war songs, and I'm wearing like the Russian clothes and stuff. And it was brilliant. But again, it was that they were giving me kindness. I had to reciprocate.
Yeah.
Because the gift of giving is only accessible to us if the other person is willing to receive. So if I give you something and you don't accept it, then you're denying me the gift of giving. So you're denying me the opportunity to be kind. And I couldn't deny those boys the opportunity to be kind. You know, they wanted to impress this foreigner boy as much as I wanted to impress them. They wanted to show, like, us Russians, whatever you see in Hollywood, we're people too. We're humans. You know, we're training to fight these guys if a war ever came. But that's not us. That's the machine around it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I get caught up. And the funny thing is that they couldn't speak a word of English. So for all these days, there was one of them had a sister who could speak English in, you know, not really, but she was, they would phone up their sister and it would be like, my brother, he like you. Oh, that's cool. Tell your brother, I think he good guy. And it went, and this went on for days. He'd just phone, would eventually come back and I'd be like, my brother say, you're the best guy. Say your brother is the best guy. And then and this is how we communicated, and then we would drink some more vodka and play some more songs, and then that phone would come in and I'd be hammered, the phone would materialize again, man. You know.
Oh, that's awesome.
Awesome times, man.
Yeah. Yeah, bless. Yeah, and I think that, you know, it's so intoxicating too, that feeling of connection. When you're finding yourself in a moment of just kind of introspection, it's like, I'm on a train here with all these Russians playing guitar, having an awesome time, and knowing I could have chosen to be in that cubicle at the front of the train, bored and waiting to arrive, instead of you're just kind of on the journey, enjoying the journey. And that's what it's all about. And that's what I'm really hearing too all the time, is like, through kindness, through saying hello to people, it's that ability to enjoy the ride, to enjoy the journey. Because otherwise, yeah, I think we all have goals and I think we all want to achieve a lot of things. And like you say, sometimes we get there, we have those degrees, but then we're still just in that doing mode. We're only being when we're kind of expressing ourselves with other people from our authentic self, not just that nice guy mask. Mm. Incredible. What about the president's dinner? How did that happen?
How the hell did that happen? I have these things, man. Again, yeah. Comes through people just hooking me up.
Yeah.
I'll tell you what happened to me on Friday.
Yeah.
I got an email on Friday saying that I had been awarded an award from the King of Sweden. This fellowship. Because when I arrived in Sweden, April 2015, I got a phone call saying there was a massive earthquake in Nepal, and I had been through Nepal. I don't know why the phone call came to me, but it came through. The news is coming through overnight. Massive earthquake in Nepal, and we can't get access to the region. And trust me, it is rough terrain. Nepal is difficult to get up to.
Yeah,
and it was the most difficult journey of my life, actually, going up from India to Nepal up the Himalayan mountains. It drained me so much.
But you got a phone call and you were on a plane the next day?
Or? No, it wasn't even that. I had just come to Stockholm a few months before and they were like, this is the issue we have. We don't know what's going on. And I thought, what can I do to help? I says, let me contact some people I know in Microsoft in Seattle and see if I can get like 1,000 mobile phones. Because I was connected to the Scouts network and I thought, if we can get like 1,000 mobile phones, get them into the Scout networks, who gets them into the search and for the search and rescue teams that are out there. Because these people live in the villages, they're Scouts. The Scouts are living in every village on Earth.
Yeah.
If we can get them to the Scouts, we can then tell these people to run up into their villages and take photos and videos where they can then, you know, send back live information. Like, this is a photo, this is a video of how my village or my town looks. This is the state it's in. And then they can sort of put a hierarchy on where do we need to send resources ASAP.
Yeah.
And so I made that call. The phones went through Microsoft Seattle with work from the other Microsofts, and it got signed off. And within hours, they were on a plane to Nepal.
Fantastic.
Or one of those.
Quick and, thinking.
But teamwork.
Yeah,
like loads of people involved, thinking, of course.
Yeah.
But that was what we came up with. Like, let's let the people who can run up these mountains by foot document it and send it back. And it was the first time that technology and humans had ever worked together with geotagging and that type of stuff in that type of situation. And I've done loads of stuff since. Like, someone phones me up and says, can you help? The answer is yes. Like, as best I can, I will help.
Yeah.
And in that situation, it sounds more romantic now, but it was just, what can we do? You know, phone calls and emails. That's what I did.
Yeah.
And So that was a great honor for, this is a great honor that I'm going to receive. It was a better thing last, it's like pass, that was like passing an exam on Friday and then yeah. the graduation will be meeting the king. So I'll be more excited about it then than I will be when it comes.
Yeah.
But meeting presidents of Ireland and stuff was, I got invited to dinners, man. Like, why did I get invited to those dinners? The Irish president, I mean, that's a great honor for me to meet those people.
Mm.
You know, and I think the first one I got invited to was through being an accountant. They were, I'm still a chartered accountant. I'm a member. And I think the first one was actually through that. I got to meet and I've been able to meet, I set up the Irish Chamber of Commerce. I was on the board for that, for Stockholm as well. And we had the Prime Minister here. So we had met him. And so I make myself available, man.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's usually because I make myself available, people say, this is what these people are having this, or these people are going to be there. And we'd like to invite you along. And of course, I have a rule. So I have a rule. I will always say yes. When people invite me somewhere, no matter where I am in the world, I will always say yes. So if I'm in Russia and someone's been following me on social media or whatever, and they see that I'm in their town and they reach out and say, I want to invite you to my home for goat soup.
Mm.
Absolutely, bro. Like, I'll be there. Where is it? Like, like level 30 on these big Soviet apartment blocks?
Yeah.
No elevator? No? All right, I'll climb up. See you up there. And that's how I ended up in Sweden.
Mm.
I wrote a book called Life Is, the book I've talked about. I love Swedish winter. I love it. I think it's beautiful. Snow and the coziness. And the, you know, the candles outside all the restaurants and on the floor.
Mm.
I love that, man.
Mm.
Oh, I love it. And I've done the PR and media for my book. And we had just come to Västerås for Christmas to spend, and a couple of guys who had been following my travels around the world at that time reached out and says, we see you're in Västerås, would you come to Mudgallerian to meet us, Rafika, in the Mellandagener, you know, between Christmas and New Year's? And I was like, invite? Yeah, the answer has to be yes. So I says, I'll meet you there, say Thursday or whatever. And they come down and they say, would you be willing to move to Sweden to help us build this company with Microsoft based out of a new hub called Epicenter, which is opening next month?
Yeah.
And I was like, you know what, man, I like the Swedes. I like the people. And three things I like about Swedish people from traveling the world is, number one, they drink me under the table. They can party, man. Number two, funny. They make me laugh. Like when the Swedes let their hair down, and they're a good crack, man. They make me laugh a lot. And number three, I trust them. No matter where we are in the world, no matter what we're doing, no matter how drunk we are, we all get home safe.
Yeah.
And they're good. I mean, this is like us in Namibia. This is us in Thailand or wherever, and you meet a Swedish lads or Swedish girls, and you're like, all right, we're going to have good crack. We're going to get drunk, but we're all getting home safe.
Yeah.
You know, back to our hostel, whatever.
Yeah.
And they're characteristics that I appreciate.
Yeah.
So I thought, you know what? I've just got married. I've been working in a real way for 7 years, and I could give Sweden a go for like a year. And here I am 6 years later, still sitting there.
I'm curious. What's your favorite question to ask people?
Why?
Why? Yeah.
People will tell you something. Like I tell you, like I did say, but people will never follow up. So when people tell me they're doing a qualification or they're working in a certain place, I'll say why. And then they have to think about that. And it works out good or bad for them, because they're like, why am I working with these asshole people? Or, do I really want to be And I asked them why. And I'm asking them why with curiosity. And I'm also asking them to ask themselves why. Because by me asking why, it's probably the first time they've been asked.
Yeah.
Because in Sweden, you're not supposed to question anything. You're supposed to just go, oh, man, that's cool.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, no, but that's cool. That is cool, but why?
Why? Yeah. And then ask why five more times. It's always interesting where you get.
Yeah. And you're off myself as well. Like, why am I doing this? Like, why are these people?
I'm curious then, like what I really like about our conversation so far is that it's been so much about being, but your first life was this huge part about doing, but you also said that you have these new goals, these three new goals. If you don't mind sharing them, what are your goals for your life right now?
My goal now is that in the next 2 weeks, I'm going to have a daughter, my first child, a Stockholm girl.
Congratulations.
And we're going to bring this beautiful soul to the world. And that's my goal. My goal is to be a good, I want to bring a daughter to the world who because she's here, the world is slightly better. I want her to be a girl who is kind to people. I want her to be a girl who lives from a heart-based center, where she sees people as the individuals they are and not the collective that they come from or try to fit into. Like just seeing people is a superpower in this world.
Oh, superpower.
And seeing things as they are.
Yeah, I think Oprah just said, like, what's Dwayne The Rock Johnson's superpower? You know, an actor who now people are calling to be a president, please. Yeah, it's seeing people. Seeing people. Yeah.
To see people, man.
Yeah.
And that's, I have a big goal now around the next generation, like making sure that my daughter is filled up sufficiently with love and kindness and happiness and just cuddles and kisses and all the stuff a wee daughter needs growing up in this world, where there's so many touch points where girls are having to compare themselves to others through social media and all these things.
Yeah.
You know, the number of girls, I don't know if you've ever seen the chart that shows you since the launch of the iPhone. And the use of iPhone since 2008 amongst teenage girls, the number of girls who are being admitted to hospital through self-harming. No, not self-harming, but being admitted to hospital because they've damaged themselves so much through self-harming. Yeah. And for me, that breaks my heart, man.
Yeah.
Because girls, like this is, I wrote a book called Forgive Me, Sister, a few years ago, a novel. And in this novel, it's about the empowerment of the feminine. Everything in this world is very masculine, very machine orientated, very systematic. And even the words we use, like crushing it and killing it, and, you know, go and execute and go and, you know, all this. It's very masculine. It's very warlike.
Very, very masculine.
You know, it's negative. It's very negative. But so this is a novel, and it's a book that I got when I was at a retreat in the Netherlands. And I basically just downloaded it, man, and channeled it. And I wrote the book in 3 weeks. And it took me like 2 years basically to tweak it and to make sure it went out, because the start of the book is very rough, and the start of the book is it was intentionally so written in a way that it would shock people into it. And when I wrote the book, there's this scene in the first two pages. It's just a two-page scene, and it's whenever I'd market tested it with amongst girls and women, the weirdest thing for me was that women under 30 didn't blink, didn't even notice it. They just kept reading, and it didn't shock them at all. They were just like, meh. Women over 30 were like, I'm not reading no more your book, Patrick. I'm done. This is too much. I'm done. And I was like, how do I tweak this to make it more visible or more extreme for women under 30, but tweak it in a way where women over 30 want to keep reading and realize that this is an analogy for something else. And the book has, I don't think there's anything, any part of that book, I don't think there's any review on that book on any platform that's not a 5-star review.
Wow.
And it's difficult, man. Like, and I don't know why I was given that book, why I was the one who was gifted as a man to write a book about empowering femininity. But the one thing about it is that a lot of lads, like lads, not just boys, but lads who are like lad culture type people read it. And they're like, yeah, man, we need to be more feminine. We need to work from more of a heart-centered place. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, and you know, it's so tough today too, because like you said, like because the machinery around us is so focused on being male and masculine, it's like it has to be such a clear intention within yourself that I'm going to work on the feminine. Because if you don't put that clear intention, it doesn't come naturally, because it's so easy to kind of push yourself into the masculine when you're uncomfortable or really need to be vulnerable, and instead you try to be strong. And you know, with myself too, I think I'm lucky enough to have a wonderful mom. I'm lucky enough to have, you know, brothers who we have conversations with each other where we're constantly reminding ourselves to kind of raise our feminine energy and to dare to be open, dare to be vulnerable, and dare to kind of surrender to whatever what is. But it is difficult. I also hold these sound journey sessions, and it's a lot of throat singing and handpan. And, you know, it's so interesting how each sound journey is so unique based on the group composition. When you have, you know, 12 males, it's just like, whoa, it gets primal. Like, it gets extremely warrior-ish. And just the other week, I had a session where there was, you know, a clear majority of females. And so there's a lot more of a feminine energy. And I noticed how, you know, and holding in the space, you know, in the masculine sense, I'm very comfortable because it's so much about like driving it to the very peak, like in the music, in the energy, it's very expansive. Whilst in a feminine energy, it tends to be much more fluid, much more sensing. So like as soon as anybody, and it's a lot of co-creation during these sessions. And as soon as a mistake is made, the group kind of just, you know, really hears it in, and it's like, oh, what happened there? Whereas if you're in males, everybody's just, bruh. So, you know, nobody cares if a mistake is made. And it was so, and, you know, I was just struggling throughout the session to find my way into it. And I realized by the end of the session, you know, and in conversation with my partner who I do the sessions with, there's just like, man, I could not integrate the feminine. I just did not want to surrender. I did not want to just allow the space to be the space it was supposed to be. And instead, I was this big man who was trying to, you know, bring up the energy and be expansive in a way that wasn't what the night needed. And of course, it was a wonderful session, a wonderful sound journey. And you know, this is me being, you know, criticizing myself on the micro level or on every single detail. But it's so difficult to integrate the feminine.
Yeah. But the way I would treat that as well, because I do some chanting for people as well, and I've done shaking sessions, you know, where you get the drums and stuff going. And I usually am doing those, because I've wrote that book, Forgive Me, Sister, I'm usually the only guy that's invited to talk at women's conferences and different things like that. So whenever I pull out those tools, it's usually when I'm surrounded by feminine energy. And I'm in a situation where it's mostly women or lads who understand their feminine energy and can sort of tip in and out. So I have never had that experience where it was just lads. But I have to be honest, I would like to, because it's also perfect. Like those lads needed to be there to turn up, because that's a positive masculine.
Yes, absolutely. You know,
it's a real it's lads coming together to be in a positive masculine space.
Yeah.
Where they all benefited from it, and they probably all went home as better men.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think there's a great service in that somewhere, some level too. But you were just saying there about your brothers and stuff.
Hmm.
Can you elaborate on that? Like some of the stuff that you are talking about and the conversations you are going on in that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot has to do with the fact that, you know, I think all three of us are very abstract thinking. We all have very high goals. We all have this sense, like if you look here to my left, your right, there's the Dragon Ball series, and there's this little kid called Son Goku, and he arrives on Earth, and he doesn't know it, but he's an alien. He's a Saiyan, which are these warrior people, and he arrives on Earth. And he thinks he's a human, but he has this superhuman strength, and he just fights people and stronger enemies throughout the series. But he's really driven by kindness too.
Mm-hmm.
He has this cloud called a Yindian, and only the people with a clean and beautiful heart can jump on it. And he's the only one who can sit on the Yindian at the same time as he's this huge warrior spirit. And so from a very early age, we got the sense of the kindness, the feminine energy, and the very warrior spirit in Son Goku and Dragon Ball. Wow. And we've all kind of been, and also he's a superhero, and all three of us loved it. And I think when we look at the world now as young adults, you know, we want to be superheroes too. Like me doing a podcast, trying to connect people. It's one part of me just trying to be kind, hear people out and understand them. But it's also my wish to be a superhero and to really connect the world and to end war and to end terror and end despair. And I have this genuine sense of belief that I can do that. But how do you change the world? I think that for a lot of, you know, brothers and for a lot of male friends, you set these high goals and then you go out and you have conversations that are always about pumping yourself up, but you don't really address the real negative sides to any relationship. You don't hold the space to really listen each other in, to cry, to be weak in front of each other. And so when you say, like, you know, what kind of conversations are they? Well, they're the conversation where we're not looking for either one of us to be right. There's no right answer to this conversation. There's no right answer to this argument. And so we're just going to have to feel like, you know, listen, and try to integrate what other people have said, the other brother has said, and then it's my turn to speak, and really trying to not cut each other off, really try to respect what the other person has said, even though you don't agree with it. And in that way, we feel like we're, you know, raising our feminine energy and not trying to be so macho, hugging each other, you know, being intimate in a way where we're giving each other cuddles. We're telling each other how awesome we are. Of course, from a kind point of view, not a nice point of view.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's the kind of conversation where, yeah, we talk a lot about our feelings.
It's beautiful.
You know, and also, you know, like my brother, he's an insanely aware person in the sense that he can smell bullshit and intention and misaligned intentions very, very well. And he also has no fear. So he'll tell people exactly what he sensed. And it throws a lot of people off when you meet a person who, and so, and even myself, you know, I most of the times I'm kind, but of course, sometimes I slip into the nice with my brother and you know, he's so good at, for example, in my communication with him, to just always point out when I'm being nice and not kind. But it's those conversations, and I think, and allowing them to happen and not, you know, punching each other's face in, not reacting with that masculine punch.
I think being nice takes so much energy, and it's like fugazi, like it's just, why are you wasting this energy when you could actually be kind? Like it's the same amount. It probably is a lot more easier and a lot more truthful and rewarding just to do the kind energy.
Absolutely.
And just this that you talk about these books and the character.
Yeah.
It's one thing. This is the other advice I have for people. When don't let people mistake your kindness for weakness.
Yeah.
Most people don't, and they would never think about it, and they appreciate the kindness that you're receiving.
Mm.
However, we are living in a society where some people think that because you're being nice to them, that you must be weak.
Yeah.
And I have a rule that if you mistake my kindness for weakness, I cut you off. And it comes back to that warrior part of me, and again, you think I'm being weak because I'm being kind to you?
Yeah.
Like, I'm being kind to you. I'm giving you the opportunity to, you know, I want you to win in life, and you're treating me like I'm a mug. I'm like, there's 7 billion other people on earth I can be kind to, but I won't be kind to you anymore, and I won't be anything to you. It's just, I'm not there. Like, you don't get any of my energy. You can be around me, but it's over.
Yeah.
And I have that in me, and it's not so much for me. There is people who want to be kind and do get taken advantage of, and I want people to realize, like, don't do that. Don't do that.
Yeah, it's the Mr. Nice Guy syndrome. And I've definitely found myself in places of life, because I, similar to you, my mom, and this is, I think one of my core being elements has always been kindness. Growing up, I've always looked out for the bullied kids, even if that meant that I wasn't hanging out with the cool kids. Mm-hmm. I just hung out with the bullied kid. And if I wasn't strong enough to, you know, stop the fight had the courage to stop the fight, I would at least always, you know, go and do my best afterwards. But I'd like to think that I also stepped into the fights at least.
Same.
But there was definitely a point when I noticed how that being kind was being, because I was in a toxic masculine environment where that was being used against me. That will kill your kindness.
Yeah.
When people say, you know, so you have to be really careful. And I think, like you said, I love the fact that you mentioned that anger is not a bad emotion. Like, you need to feel your anger. And sometimes anger is something that, you know, that inner warrior is telling you, like, it's time to get angry. Yeah. It's time to show that you're not weak. You're kind, but you're not weak.
Yeah.
And I know that we're a little bit short on time. And so we have about 5 more minutes here. And I'm curious how, you know, my goal with this podcast is to challenge our basic assumptions and approach to life in the 21st century. And I think, you know, a huge part of why I think we need to challenge it is because I think, you know, in order to get our planet to thrive, it's this mix of living in a digital environment that allows us, we have to be very good at self-education, I think, and in updating ourselves. But a lot of it is also kind of rooted in these ancient values of kindness, the golden rule, which I feel like we've forgotten a little bit in the modern age because prestige and success became more important than love and compassion. And I'm curious, how would you say that you challenge our life and approach in the 21st century? What other than kindness, what else do you do to survive in this physical and digital world?
I'm very aware. So what I have talked about the entire talk so far has been my relationship with the external, with the people who come across my world, not so much the world, but my world, people I bump into. The other relationship I'm so careful about is the relationship I have with myself. We are probably all dopamine junkies at this stage because we've been bombarded so much with notifications and likes and feedback telling us how awesome we are or not. And we all crave it. I don't drink alcohol. I don't smoke. I don't gamble. I don't take drugs. I don't do any of the stuff that provides us with dopamine. And I have for many years tried to do 366 day challenges where I will start or stop something for a year. So I will not drink alcohol for a year, for example, and then I just stayed off it, or I started doing yoga for a year and kept on it. You know, these types of things, start or stop something and give it a go. And what has happened with that is I've always tried to fight against the things which are trying to encroach on my life. So I don't generally have any apps on my phone. Like, I don't have any messenger apps at all. I never have, because why should people from around the world want to contact me and tell me, send me memes and stuff like that? I mean, it doesn't really benefit me. You know, I would rather sit here without intrusion and talk to you about the world, talk to your brothers about trees, or talk to somebody else about football, you know, than be getting memes and stuff like that from people. At the same time, whenever I go on social medias, I don't have any apps. I will download Instagram from time to time, and I will do a few posts, and I get caught in the, so I get pulled in so heavy. Oh, that addiction, man.
So good.
And then I delete it maybe after 3 days, and then I'm done. And then I think, okay, I must post something else. And then I'm, it's like I go through this junky tunnel of dopamine where I post stories and everything. Yeah. But I'm very aware of the fact that this is what this is. This is, you put it so well earlier. I might not know the internet, but the internet knows me.
Yeah, if you don't understand the internet understands you.
That's it.
And they're gaming our attention. And if you don't spend attention on yourself, well, you're spending it somewhere else.
Absolutely. And that's what I'm aware of. And that's really well put. So I'm always, it's like if you were an alcoholic or a gambler, you know, when you were addicted to either of those things, you just wouldn't go to the bookies or you wouldn't go to the pub. So I just don't let the bookie or the pub come to my phone. I just make sure that I don't have those companies which are, so they're getting smarter and smarter every time we use it. The more we use it, the stronger they get, the more they're aware of us.
Yeah.
So as a result of that, I just keep them off my phone until I want. So it's like going to the pub on a Friday night. Yeah. You go in and you leave. I'll dip in, I'll go into social media, and then I'll leave. Yeah. And it's just a matter, and I've never had notifications and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So we are 21st century freaks, and we do live in this world, and we are off this world, but we have to be very careful about how much we give to the world, because we don't have that much to give. Our time is the most precious thing we have. And if I was to start scrolling through reels on Instagram, 2 hours gone, like what?
Yeah.
Huh? You know? And therefore I'm selfish with my time in a regard, and I'm becoming more so like that. Like, quality is always better than quantity.
Yeah.
And quality things, quality operate, just having quality people around you, quality time, quality books, quality knowledge. I also don't have any, I don't have a subscription to anything. Nothing.
That's very good. Yeah.
Nothing. No subs.
So then what are you and your wife, what do you guys like to do when you're on a Saturday night, you're chilling, you don't have a baby yet?
I actually love walking. I love to walk, actually. I love trees. Too. I'm a tree hugger, man.
Oh, God, tell me about it. Oh, just touching those bad boys. You know. Just feeling them in. Oh, I'm all in. Yeah.
So I love nature, and I think I live in one of the most beautiful cities in the world for that, where we have a really nice intermix of great infrastructure of cabanas and, you know, Pendletogs and everything else, which drops us off in these amazing hubs of nature.
Yeah.
I live at Pampas Marina, which is a 15-minute cycle from the city center.
Yep.
And I see deers. Yeah. I see deers outside my apartment. Foxes, badgers, rabbits. It's close to the Western Forest of Stockholm.
Yeah.
It's covered in trees.
Yeah, it's one of my absolute favorite parts about Stockholm is how they've integrated, you know, nature into the city. Mm. And they're so keen on, you know, let's not turn everything into a parking lot. No, we're gonna keep our green areas, and you take the subway into town. Yeah, you can take your car, but you're gonna be miserable.
Yeah. You're not in the traffic. Yeah. You are the traffic.
I like that. Awesome, Patrick. Well, is there anything else you'd like to end with to tell the listeners that you might not have covered so far? I'm sure that's 10 hours of conversation, like you're saying. But
I think one thing that I think people should always be aware of, and if it's one thing that you can take from this, is that I'm trying to always be as true as possible to myself. And that's a struggle. That's a difficult one. You know, so if you have an intention to be as true as possible to yourself without encroaching too far on other people, just searching to be yourself, it actually unfolds. A lot of the stuff we talked about, the kindness is all in there, the femininity is in there, the giving, the caring, the sharing, the adventure, the lack of fear, it's all in there. But it's whenever we take on other people's beliefs and stuff like that is where the fear kicks in. So if you can stay truest to yourself as possible, or at least work towards it, or find ways where you can do that, that's what I would say take away from this conversation, because that's what it all really truly comes back to.
Yeah. Thank you. And I just like to reflect back that it's been an absolute pleasure to set this conversation up. Just the way you approach any conversation, It you know, I like to think of myself as, you know, a people opener. I like to crack people up and make them feel and be happy. But you cracked me up and made me feel and be happy and to be even more courageous than I am otherwise in telling people I love them and loving myself and just being true to what I really believe in. Just your way of acting and engaging in the world, it's sending that vibe into me. And I really appreciate that. So thank you.
Thank you.
And this conversation has been a pleasure. You're a true gem. And I can't wait for you to raise a daughter in this world and to make her somebody special.
Thank you. I appreciate that a lot.
All right. Well, listeners, over and out. Bye-bye.